going to fix that.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. Lee's going to fix the camera in a second. In the meantime, I can remain anonymous. I just want to thank all of you for being here and the committee, all the other speakers, and it's really been quite a weekend. And I want to thank Anna and Roland for taking care of me, getting my health back and fixing me so I can keep walking. So I'm really grateful for that also. I know when you get to the end of the convention, you hate to see it end, because there'll never be another one like this. There'll be another one next year, but this one we were all part of, and we'll all go our separate ways, but we'll have our memories of talking with each other and being together and realizing how big and powerful AA is and how it's made up of just one person after another. That's it. And so everybody in this room plays an equal role in producing the whole that we have. This is always hard, but I do want to share about my daughters, because it may be useful to other people who are faced with situations like that. And so on March 3rd of this year, I got a call from my middle daughter, Conway, who has 9 years in AA, that she had just found the body of her sister, Barbie, who had 5 years in AA. And she had taken her daughter to high school, and when she came home, somebody was waiting for her and hit her over the head and stabbed her a bunch of times and left her there. And Conway just did a remarkable job of being the strength in the family. There's three boys and my ex-wife. We had six kids together, and cousins and so on down. And they gathered, and I had just had surgery, and I couldn't go up. And it was very frustrating, because I wanted to be there to help. But when something like that happens, it gets complicated. You got the press and the police, and you can't go in the house, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. It just makes it 10 times as hard. And so it was probably 3 weeks later when the memorial service, and my friend Chris, who takes me everywhere, I wouldn't get around without him, and Christine, they're going to give me a ride home. And so he went up to Connecticut with me, and we went to the memorial service, and it was very beautiful, and there were maybe 50 family members and 300 AAs. And it was held in an old church on the green in Guilford, and it was just beautiful. And at that service was my oldest daughter, Catherine, who is in the late stages of alcoholism, or was, and she was very sick. She was throwing up during the service, and so my middle daughter Conway and I, we told her we're going to come to her house, and this can't go on. She has four boys, and we're going to, you know, we've been talking about her alcoholism for a long time. And she told me she loved me, that she was so glad I was her father, but she was not going to let me come there, and that she would call the police if we came. And her husband went along, and so 3 months later, she died of alcoholism. And it's a very bad death. When you get cirrhosis and it kicks the kidneys out, it's just awful. And so those events all happened roughly within a three-month period. So I want to tell you what it felt like and what I did in order to go through those things. And in order to do that, I have to tell you the role models that I had, that I paid attention to as I went through life. And the first one was about 25 years ago in Washington, D.C. And I was watching the local TV, and a charming black woman was being interviewed on television, and her son had just been murdered. He was like an A student, and he was in the wrong place, and some other kid shot him. And the reporter just had this microphone in her face. Why do you feel about the boy that killed your son today? And she said, I've already forgiven him. And there was complete peace on her face. I couldn't believe my ears. I couldn't believe what I had just seen and heard, that she had already forgiven him. And I never forgot it. I used to talk about it with my friends. I said, I saw this woman do that. I had been around AA 25 years. I didn't know you could get to that level. I had no idea. I mean, I realized how far ahead she was than I was at that moment. I'm sure she was in her church and was really strong in her relationship with God. And I just saw it. In other words, when you see the face and the whole thing, it just stays with me. So I remembered seeing that. And then I had heard of one other lady in Al-Anon who did the same thing. And then we all saw on the television the Amish, when they had the murder in their community, and the family of the boy that was murdered went over to the family of the boy that did the killing to comfort them. And I just went, boy. So those are... But as I saw him, I said, well, that's possible for anyone. And so what I learned out of this is, while my daughter was telling me about this incident, something made me totally accept it in that second. So I wasn't going to fight the universe about it. It had happened. So I accepted that from that moment on, my relationship with my daughter Barbie was on a new level. It would consist of memories and stories. And I can tell you stories about her for a long time. And she will continue. And it felt good inside. And I also decided to forgive whoever did it. I could really care less. They still haven't decided. Everybody thinks it's her ex-husband. Probably could be, but it's of little interest to me. Because whoever it is forgiven. And all I had left was sorrow. And God helps with sorrow, but he doesn't help with hatred. He doesn't help with resentment. And he doesn't help with anger. Because those are self-induced. That's ego deciding this shouldn't have happened. And most of all, it shouldn't have happened to me. You find, it's okay, I read in the paper it happened to you. Hey, well, I care. But it shouldn't happen to me. And so I'm just telling you that the sorrow is still there, and I tear up whenever I think I'm going to start talking about it. But then when I get started, I'm all right. And so the lesson is that the real value of acceptance and forgiveness occurs in the moment that it happens. That's where the real value is. It happens, you accept. You get fired, you accept. And you can go out and start looking for another job, and you won't be angry, resentful, and unfit for an interview. Who wants to hire this angry woman? You see what I'm saying? So that was the new lesson for me, was you do the acceptance and forgiveness now. Otherwise, resentment, anger, and hatred get in, and then you can't get them out. You can try, but they just stay there, and they stay there, and they stay there. And the other thing that I had read about in a lot of readings that I do, when I found out, I kind of knew that my oldest daughter was, you know, something was going to happen someday. And so when I got the same call from my daughter Conway, she was in the hospital and up in Virginia, and that this had happened. The first thing that I did, I didn't react to it. I went to God, and I said to God, I just want you to know how much I love you. I want to spend time with you because you're more important than anything. And I want to assure you that any of these events that are happening to me don't change how I feel about you. And that really kept everything solid. And after a few minutes of that, then I turned back to the situation, and I was relatively comfortable with it. I just said, well, when that happened, we'll have this service, and we'll help the family, and we'll go through this. And again, I accept and didn't get angry over it. So you can see the role that God plays in everything. It's how soon do you want to let him in? Okay, that's all I wanted to comment on that. And then I can get back to my exciting story. So you can see the importance of the now. Do it now. Anyway, in the time I have left, I will tell my story a little bit. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, near where a lot of my relatives still live. My sister has 33 years in AA up there. My parents went through the Depression, but they somehow kept their act together and did a good job of taking care of my sister and I. There was this family. Everybody was nice, and I didn't feel I belonged in it. Everybody in this room tells a story similar to that. I sat around the table, four people sitting around the table. There's the three of them and me. And I don't know what that is, but alcoholics seem to do that. My mother was Catholic. She brought us up Catholic. My sister and I sat in the same pew. She found the most welcome home. She still goes there. She loves it. She loved the nuns. She loved the Latin, the incense, the confessionals, the whole nine yards. I, on the other hand, I didn't see it that way. I saw sort of a prison camp, secret. Don't trust anybody wearing those outfits. And I just never saw God as a friend. I saw him as an enemy. He's going to get me. And I knew what the confessionals, they're gathering evidence for later. When put you on trial and all that kind of stuff. So I got no comfort out of going in there. I just was uncomfortable the whole time. I would get dizzy because I would just keep imagining all the horrible things that are going to happen. But somehow I got through there, and I went through school. I had polio when I was about 10. I was very lucky that the Sister Kenny treatment worked in a very small number of people, these hot packs and therapy, so I lost the use of my arm and leg, and I got most of it back. And I went to a little prep school in New Haven, probably 40 people in a class, wonderful teachers, so I'm getting high grades, pipeline right into Yale, the local university. When I got there, I had worked on their buildings. I knew all about the place. But when I got there and was a student, I saw all the rest of the students were like rich guys. And I recognized some of their names. And I'm going, holy cow, I don't belong in here. I'm supposed to work on the buildings. I'm not supposed to be inside going to school. So I just felt so threatened the whole time. My roommates are telling, come on, drink, we're in college. No, I'm going to get high grades. I want to try out for athletics and all these things. But I'd been there a couple months, and it was just so uncomfortable. I was thinking of just quitting. And I went to a social event to meet these people. My name was typed on a list. Go in this room. Here's these other guys. Go around, shake hands, say hello. Well, I don't know how to do that. That is too threatening. And I looked at their eyes as I came in. I was looking for a friendly face. There wasn't one. Everyone was kind of looking at me like, don't come over to our group. We have enough friends. We don't need you. And it was unanimous. I didn't see one friendly face. So I said, well, I better leave here. That's how I solved anxiety, just leave. But they had a bar, and I said, well, maybe I'll just have a drink, see what this is all about. They said it makes you feel happy, and so I drank two, and nothing happened. And halfway through the third one, I just put the glass down. I just went, boy, I don't get this. Well, boy, when I turned around, everyone in that room wanted to know me. With their eyes, they were begging me to come over to their group, and I didn't know where to start. Should I start here? Holy cow. So I kind of made a decision, and I went over, and I realized how lucky they were that I was coming over. I mean, it was the whole... And it was like my whole personality was let out of jail where it had been trapped by anxiety and fear and all those things. And I just was exploding all over, talking. And pretty soon they're leaving. Where are you going? Where are you going? Here's all these people I'm afraid of. And I'm going, where are you going? Where are you going? And they all finally went. So I went back to the bar and I said, boy, 3 drinks to Dad. What about 20? And so I had, I don't know how many, but I went and got as sick as you can get all night and sat on the bed the next morning just throbbing and just, oh, my God. I said, I just don't know if I'm going to survive. And in that moment, I had the thought, are you going to drink again tonight? And I'll tell you, was it 1/100th of a second? Yes, I am. This puking and dying is a small price to pay for what I had last night. If that's what it takes to live in that world, fine with me. Little did I know the price was going to get bigger and the fun was going to get less, so the only thing that had to improve was my ability to rationalize, to continue to tell myself that puking in a nut ward was worth it. So the grades went and the athletics went and trouble started, and I'm getting in fights, I'm going to jail, and by some miracle, I graduate by 0.1%. And the Korean War was going on, so we had to join the military, and a bunch of guys had a beer, let's join the Marine Corps. Okay, yeah, boy, hey, hi. And I'm sure that recruiting guy saw us coming in, just going, just sign here, boys, just sign here. And boy, that, the Marine Corps has a great welcome for anybody who wants to go in there. And at first it was a shock, but as time went on, I started to love it. They broke down everybody's personality and made you part of a team, and it was a great team, and I just felt like I'm at home. I didn't have any plans anyway after I graduated. I never thought about it. And so I stayed in, and after a while I saw a thing about flight school, and that looked interesting. Guys were at the bar in the training movie. And they had white scarves, and there were some women in the background, and I'm watching. I didn't see that with the guys in the foxhole. I didn't see any of that. I said, I like this. So I'd never been in a plane, but I've made it through the, I passed all the tests, and I met this lovely woman who, we had 6 children together. And so we got married, went off to Pensacola, Florida, right up the other end of the state. And I got airsick on the DC-3 United Airlines flying to Atlanta and airsick on the way to Pensacola and airsick for a number of flights in the old SNJ. But that went away, the motion sickness, and then I became very good at it. And I went through the 18 months of the formation and night flying and gunnery and bombing and carrier and all that stuff. And then advanced training in Texas, finally got into a jet. And then I went to El Toro, California for the Marine Corps training to go overseas. And by the time we got over there, the war's over, and I'm in the frontline fighter squadron, and they just partied. The colonel drank a lot, and I just fit in, and we had more fun, gunnery contests and carrier practice and all that kind of stuff. And so it was an unbelievable year where I felt I was drinking just like the other members of that squadron. I just loved it. And we had a good airplane, old North American's F-86. And about 3/4 of the way through the tour, I was out on the end of the runway with Major Newport, the maintenance officer, and we were watching the guys practice to go aboard the carrier. You make approaches on the runway, but you much slower and lower. And he's talking about getting a squadron. He's going to get all these good pilots, and he wants me, a young lieutenant. And then he looks at me, and he said, but when you're in my squadron, I won't let you drink. And this is a guy I get drunk with all the time, and so I didn't ask him. I didn't dare ask him. But I thought, why would he say that? Why would he say he wouldn't let me drink? You know what I mean? Is he saying that to all the other lieutenants or what? And it wasn't until I got in AA that I really started realizing that an alcoholic in the midst of heavy drinkers scares them. You know what I mean? They look at me and they all say, we're just getting drunk all the time. I don't know what he's doing. But it's way above what we're doing. So that was my first clue, but I didn't hear it. And so I went right on. We had six children, got transferred about every year or year and a half. That's the Marine Corps, so the kids are in a different school all the time. And I had some wonderful tours of duty. I was honored to be a forward air controller with the 1st Marine Division and 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, if there's any Marines out here. And I was a flight instructor, and then at the end I was in a photo squadron at Cherry Point, North Carolina, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we were flying the F-8 Crusader and the F-3D radar. Used to be an old night fighter. And at this point, if you looked at the outside, you would just go, look at this guy. He's got promoted. Now he's a captain. He's in this exclusive squadron. They had no lieutenants in that squadron. It was 15 pilots. Very cool. And, you know, he's got these kids. He's had all these assignments. I was almost very close to the end, but you wouldn't have been able to see it. It was happening on the inside. I was starting to have withdrawal symptoms in the airplane. I was starting to shake. I was starting to get frightened of flying with me. You know what I mean? It was, hey man, you're shaking and you're like this and you get confused and, you know, this is a fast airplane. You can't be screwing around like that. What am I going to do? There was no alcohol programs. I never heard of AA. So I just felt this. I was stuck with this. So I'm going to have to make the best of it. Now, my buddy Hal Marley, who's in AA, he's passed away. He was an Air Force pilot. And when we exchanged notes, he said, yeah, I started having withdrawal. But I knew enough to take booze with me in the airplane. You stupid Marine pilots, you go along with no drinking for 8 hours and you're in the withdrawals. Anyway, that's after the fact. At the time, it was just, I was trapped. So, for a 6-month period, it was very intimidating to get in that big airplane. And I would shake and then I felt like I was going to pass out and I'd be this and that and I can remember flying with one hand on the ejection seat, the left hand on there, the right hand on the stick. All the photo controls are on the stick. So you could do the mission with just one hand. And then my theory was if I passed out, I'd fire that seat because I had a death grip on the ejection seat. And bam, I go out. The chute opens automatically at 10,000 feet. The plane crashes. I land safely. Problem solved. You know that feeling. You can't trap the old fox here. He will come up here. He will find his way out of these things. You know, as if that was a legitimate solution to anything. The answer was don't drink, but that wasn't going to happen. So, and the months went by, and finally everything came to an end. We were in the flight of 4 airplanes, and it was a radar plane, which is easy to fly. It was straight wing, 2 engines. That damn thing even had windshield wipers. It's the only plane I ever flew with windshield wipers. And I was flying along. We were coming back from across country. I wasn't sure. I wasn't leading the flight, and I wasn't quite with it. And I knew I had to get out of the plane. I'd had these attacks before, these panic attacks, and I had one getting a haircut, and I just had told the barber, I'm out of here. He says, I'm not through. Yes, you are. I'm gone, and I'm out. I got to leave. And I had that, and I said, I got to get out of this plane now. And doesn't have ejection seat. It had a ramp that went down out of the bottom, and I don't even remember exactly how the whole thing worked. And I was studying it, and I realized the guy next to me doesn't know how to fly. He's a radar guy, so I can't get out of the plane. So I called the flight leader and declared an oxygen emergency. Told him we got oxygen problems over here, and if you have that, you have to land immediately. So he saw an Air Force base over there. We went down. I went over to the club, had a couple drinks. Whew, feel better. And they were happy that we declared the emergency because now we can drink some more at the Air Force base while we're waiting to go home. And the next morning I went down and I took a look at the plane and I told the flight leader, I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. Alcohol was just announcing to me that I was going to give up flying, which I've been doing for 14 years. And I loved it. It was who I was. It was everything. And he said, what? And I said, I'm not going to do it anymore. All right. So they got somebody else to fly. And I didn't remember how that worked, but we got back. And he said, you have to go talk to the colonel. So I went in and I said, Colonel, I'm not going to do this anymore. He said, why? I said, I'm just not going to do it. I wouldn't talk about it. And he said, you're not? No. And he says, well, I have no choice but to write the commandant of the Marine Corps and tell them that they have to give you a new assignment. It'll take about 3 months. So I was assigned to do the legal work for the squadron for those 3 months. And I didn't look anybody in the eye. I sat in that room and they would bring the work. And I could feel the rest of those pilots looking at me like, how did that piece of junk get in our squadron? And I just felt shame. I just couldn't look at anybody because I was such a screw-up. And I was so glad when I got orders away. Oddly enough, I went to air traffic control school. Did that about a year and ended up in the nut ward. And AA, and eventually lost my whole career. But that was the moment that on that cross country. And I was out in California at the Brentwood Group. They have a big group, about 500 people. And the meeting is done by, they have an old timer, or somebody's been around a while. They talk a little bit about their story, but then they talk about a topic. And then people in the audience raise their hands, and they used to have Chuck Chamberlain go there on a regular basis. And can you imagine sitting there, Chuck, could you tell me more about this or that? I mean, wow, wouldn't that have been something? And I was going to lead the meeting, and a lady was getting her 30-year medallion. Her husband drove her there. He was not in AA, but he went to meetings all the time. He knew the AA people. But that night, he was just going to go drink coffee and pick her up. And she mentioned my name, said, he's leading the meeting. He said, was he a pilot? She said, yeah. She said, I think I know him. Tell him to come out here. So I go out and see this guy. I've never seen him. He looks at me, and he says, in 1962, you were in a flight of 4 F-3D radar planes on a cross country, and you declared an oxygen emergency, and all those planes landed, and you never flew again. And I went, how do you know that? He said, I was in the plane with you. I went, you were? And he said, yes. And he wasn't the radar guy. He was a new pilot who had been recalled from American Airlines for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he later retired as a second senior pilot at American. His name was Jim Heff, and we became friends after he told me the whole story, and we talked on the phone and all that. And the next day, he came up to Oxnard and brought the photographs from the squadron. He had all this big collection, and there's the colonel and the lieutenant and the other colonel. We had 2 lieutenant colonels. And I said, oh, yeah, I remember this and that and this and that. And then he said, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? It broke our hearts that you were leaving. The colonel did everything he could. He called everyone he knew. How do I save this guy? What do I do? And we couldn't come up with anything. We felt we let you down. (Clears throat) Well, that's not the way I remember it. So, obviously one of us is wrong. And I've been sober long enough to realize I was the one that was wrong. And all that information that I had from 42 years ago had to go. I had to throw it away, erase it. So I went back to 1962 and changed 3 months of my past. If people say you can't change your past, oh, stick around. What is your past? It's your old ideas. So I took all those old ideas, shame, you know, all that stuff, threw them away. When I think back on that, I go, boy, was I lucky to be with those guys. What a great bunch of guys. I had a disease. Nobody knew how to do anything about it. They would have given anything if they knew how to save me. Wow, it's a pleasant memory. It used to make me sick to think about it. So learn that. Just because you think you remember what happened, and then you emotionally react to it when you recall it, there's a big chance you're wrong. A big chance you're wrong. And that's what spirituality is to see everything differently. And then you find out, well, actually, my mother was really trying as hard as she could. She was an alcoholic, too. Wow, when I think about that, actually, my brother was this. Actually, that first boss I had, when I look at that, boy, he gave me about 6 chances. And then he dumped me. And I've hated him to this day, but I didn't really see his side. So we go back and we start changing and getting rid of all these wrong ideas. And then we emotionally react to the new truth. And it's fun. We just love our life. And we like the world. The world's a lot more understanding than we thought. And it's a wonderful transformation process to understand. That's why I tell that story, to illustrate how powerful it is and how wrong we are about so many things. I kid around. I heard a speaker say, my story's divided into 2 parts, what happened during the years that I drank and what I thought happened during the years that I drank. And that captures it very well. It captures exactly what we're talking about. What I thought happened during my childhood. What I thought happened in grammar school. What I thought happened in high school. That's just part of it. That's what you thought happened. And you're looking at it from a very self-centered, frightened place. And so what you see is very different than what really happened. And so in a literal way, we all live in our own little world. We used to use that as a derogatory term. You know her. She lives in her own little world. Well, so do you. And so do I. And you could be married for 40 years and you still don't know that other person's little world completely. It's impossible. We know a lot about it, but we don't know it. Their world is separate from ours. And the way we resolve all this is to each one of us destroy our own little world through this process and try to all move from our little world into God's world. And that's the journey in here. Leave ours behind and try to get to God's. This is the ultimate challenge for a human being, and few people really make it all the way home before they die. St. Francis did. It came damn close when you read his life and think about his prayer. He certainly gives us a clue as to what it looks like. And so this is that story illustrates smashing part of my little world. And a writer that I was reading, he said, so that means on this planet there's 6.7 people living in their own little world. And someone said, yeah, but there's the real world. And he said, yeah, but no one lives there. I thought it was an interesting observation. Oh, yeah, yeah, I live there, but there's a real world, too. Yeah, well, no one lives there. That's a great little thought to lose sleep over for a week. And and the secret to that, if you ever run into these secrets, the secret is pray to get rid of the desire to find the answer. That's the only way. It's much faster because there is no answer. You're never going to find it, and you're going to find out that spirituality has nothing to do with learning anything. It has to do with smashing old stuff so that you can see something new. Learning about it doesn't help. It's just academic knowledge, like I learned about God. I knew where he was born. I knew this. I knew that. But it didn't help my life at all until I got into God's house and God got into my heart. And he said, hi, I'm here. And I went, God, this is great. So I experienced God as a lot different than learning about him. And as we talked about earlier, the people who mostly get to experience him are ones who are driven down to somewhere near desperation so that they smash that ego shell enough to let us look out and go, whoa, there's something out there besides my world. And how far we get out of there is up to our own individual trying, seeking. And that's what the program sets us up to do. It puts us in a perfect position through our steps to become God seekers. How much you seek is up to you. See, that the group only takes us so far. Then we're going to go as far as we can. And so it's fun to share about that. And maybe you can get people who are interested in studying a book, or these are all outside activities, but there are things to do to keep moving ahead, all within the confines of AA, all part of our wonderful program. It just enabled us to go as an individual further. Now, not further than the guy next to us, because there's no way of measuring that, further than where we used to be. You can only measure yourself. You may look at somebody over here and go, wow, look at that guy. He's grumpy all the time, whatever it is. He may be so far ahead of us, it's ridiculous. And so I don't like to ever judge anybody, because people will surprise the heck out of you. They will suddenly do the most selfless thing, and you just realize, oh, my God. Anyway, I did go, just to finish out my Marine Corps, I did become an air traffic controller. I don't know how I made it through the school. And I want to thank, there was a guy, I don't know who it is. There are certain people that I'd like to go back and thank. And one of them was the flight surgeon that was giving me my exam for flight school. And I never mentioned polio because I knew that would disqualify me from a lot of things. So I just never wrote it down. But there was the atrophy of some muscles in the back of my right shoulder. And he was feeling my back and poking. And he put his hand in that's kind of an indentation. And he said, what's this? And I went, I don't know. And I could hear him. And he had his finger in there. And he was going, And then he went, okay. I'd like to find him and thank him for saying okay. And then there was Seaman Third Class, who was in charge of the swimming in flight school. And you had to swim a mile in a pool. And I had almost drowned as a kid, and the water was, I loved to dive around and play, but being able to relax in the water was impossible. So I was not passing this test. So he had me back every night. And if you don't make it in a certain time, that's the end of flight school. It could be learning about engines. It could be this. It could be Morse code. It could be this. And so I went there every night. He says, okay, Lieutenant, try the side stroke. And I'm going and going, and I'd come up, and I'd be, half a lap shy when the time came up. So it was the last night, and I'm counting. And I'm going and going. I'm looking at the clock. I'm going and going. And I go, geez, my heart sank. And he said, "Nice going, Lieutenant, you made it." I'd like to find that guy. And the guy I'd like to find was, when I went to air traffic control school, was, I don't know his name, but he was a Marine captain. And he brought an old, they had some training planes down there so that the people who were going to control airplanes would go up and ride in the plane that was being controlled by their friends so they would see what was happening while they're on the ground talking. So I'm in the back seat, and we're going, and I knew this guy, or he knew me, or something. So we sat and talked. Obviously, I knew what it looked like to make a GCA. And we got through doing that, and he said, "Would you like to fly it for a while?" And it'd been about 6 months, and I felt better. And I used to teach in that airplane, and I took that thing and flew it, did every acrobatic maneuver I could remember, and just, it was so nice, and I gave it back to him, and that was the last time I ever flew anything. And I'd like to thank that guy, because at the time I didn't know what a big deal he was doing for me to give me those little things. So there's probably in everybody in this room, if we could go back, there are people we'd like to go back and thank, and we had no idea. Like I was talking about yesterday, go thank that cop that pulled you over, gave you a DWI, and got you in here. It's life is filled with those things. So I made it through the air traffic control school. I went to Cherry Point briefly, and then from my last year of drinking, I was overseas in an air traffic control unit, and I couldn't. The enlisted men saw me and saw how bad I was, so they just said, "Captain, you just try to get here in the morning on your bicycle. Stay in the tent. Don't go near the radar. Don't you talk to any airplane. And we'll take care of you." So that was what I was doing. I was trying to survive as I became a hopeless alcoholic. I couldn't eat anymore, so I lost 50 pounds. And I'm just drinking vodka and soup. Or juice. I put vodka in the juice, and I was shaking, and it was just awful trying to make it through that year. And I got sent back to Quantico, Virginia, to go through a career school to get promoted so you could become a colonel and so on down. And I was hallucinating going to the school. I'm right near the end. My seizure is just around the corner. It's just another month, and then I'll be locked up in the nut ward. But I'm still trying to go to this school, and I would get there, and I couldn't remember where my classroom was. I couldn't remember the combination to my locker. I wouldn't know where I sat in the room. I mean, every day was just, and people were looking at me. And I came in one day. I lived off the base in Quantico. I drove in, went up to school, and the school buildings were gone. I couldn't believe it. So I went back to the front gate to report it. And there was a Lance Corporal out there who had just saluted me in. I just went in, and now I'm coming back out, made a U-turn, came up, and he looked at me, and he said, "Yes, Captain?" And I said, "Corporal, junior school is gone. I just went up there to go to class. It's gone." He said, "Gone?" And I said, "Yes." So he got one of the cars with the red light, and we drove up to junior school. It was back. And I just looked at him, and I just said, "It's back." So I think we'd all love to be in that guard shack when he got back to tell the officer of the day what just happened. Anyway, in one of those classes, I did have a grand mal seizure. I was sent up to Bethesda Naval Hospital, put in where all the good guys are. What could have happened to this poor man? See, they had no alcohol program. And so I'm there for about 5 days, and I start hallucinating and have delirium tremens, and it was just terrifying. The CIA was trying to trap me and accuse me of being mentally crazy and lock me up forever and so on down. And I finally started screaming, and they put me in a straitjacket, and I was locked up for 6 months in the mental ward. And somehow, and they had no alcohol program, but the AA group in Bethesda talked to the head psychiatrist, who let them bring a meeting in. So I got to my first meeting, by the corpsman came in the place and said, "All drunks fall in." And there were three of us. And we went down to that meeting, and they told their stories, and I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I told the guy afterwards, I said, "This is exciting. You guys really got some. If I run into a guy that needs this, I'd like to get your number." And that guy, the little redheaded guy, he started poking my chest, and he said, "Hey, let me ask you something. I said, "Which one of us is going to go out and get in his car and drive home to his family? And which one of us is going to put his little blue bathrobe on and go upstairs and get locked up like an animal?" And I went, "Geez, I just met the guy." I was encountering AA's truthfulness right off the bat. So when I finally got released, and it was, I was let out. I'm back to duty, but I'm not going back to that school. That school was long over with. And I checked in with the officer of the day, and evidently he had gotten the word from Bethesda that an alcoholic was returning to Quantico. And he went, "An alcoholic is returning to Quantico." So he felt responsible to make sure I didn't have a drink. So he called a major, and he said, "Can you take this man home and don't let him drink?" This shows you how primitive all this was. And it was a Friday, and the guy who was going to take me home was another major. He said, "Well, listen, I'm going to happy hour in the club. And you're going to go with me, but you're going to stand over in the corner and just have a Coke." And so I went over in the corner, and I'd been standing there a while, and he had a few drinks, and it wasn't enough. He went up to the bar and rang that thing where you get everybody's attention, and he pointed over at me and said, "That man's an alcoholic. If you see him drinking, tell me." So that's what the dark ages of alcoholism looked like. It was just, he didn't know what it was, but he didn't want to be caught having an alcoholic do something on his watch. But anyway, I got a good job. I got onto a very special team. I don't know how I got this job. It was headed by a general, and we went all over Europe to the Royal Marines and the Dutch Marines and the German Marines and put on a big show about the future of the Marine Corps. We had an aviator, an artilleryman, a naval gunfire guy, and an infantry guy, and we put on this big thing, and Huntley Brinkley did the lead-in to the whole thing. It was like a news show 5 years ahead to show all the weapons and the new things, and I somehow made it through that. I had 6 months sobriety. I'm with the Royal Marines, and they're toasting the Queen, and I thought, I've got this damn glass in my hand. I thought I could start an international incident if I don't drink, but somehow I didn't. I put it up, and we have the Queen, okay, and now if I'm sober, I'd just be over there, and they say, "Where's your drink?" Who cares about the Queen? I'm just sitting here. I'm having a good time. But there was a lot of pressure, when you're new. But somehow I made it through all that. And I didn't get promoted to major, and I'm out of the Marine Corps with my 6 kids, and I'm trying to get a job, and I'm doing this. And I had a big resentment about how the Marine Corps treated me. And so at a discussion meeting, somebody asked if anybody had a topic. Oh, yes. Getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. I'd like that to be the topic. And they said, "That's not a good topic, Sandy. I mean, how are we going to comment on it?" "Well, I want to hear it. It's my topic." And All right. The topic is getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. First guy. Just say the serenity prayer. It works for everything. Now, the reason I brought that topic up was I figured somebody in that audience was going to say, you just got thrown out. Are you available? I own a corporation up here in D.C. I'm looking for a man like you. Would you, how about 65,000 a year in your own car, expense account? What do you think? I don't hear that. I hear, say the serenity prayer. Next guy, double up on your meetings. You got a lot of time. Go help the new person. Don't think about yourself.
Thank you, thank you.
Say the prayer of St. Francis. St. Francis was a Marine, and he learned to live without anything. And I went home that night, and I said, I don't really think I explained my problem very well to these people. I had no idea they were giving me the secret to everything. And I remember years later, I think I went through a divorce, and now the bankruptcy. You know, just because you're sober, you can have some fun with life. And I think I brought up, after facing bankruptcy after 12 years or whatever it was. And so, anybody been through it, this and that? Same thing. Oh, yeah, bankruptcy, serenity prayer. You just want to say the serenity prayer as often as you can. Next guy said, well, why don't you write down the eating meetings? At least you can get free food when you go there. Work with new people. Take your mind off of being broke. Prayer of St. Francis. He took a vow of poverty. So, completely different problem, exactly the same solution, and of course we all know it. There's only one solution in here. And Chuck Chamberlain said it. I brought it up yesterday. There's only one problem. It includes all problems. Conscious separation from God. There's only one answer that includes all answers, conscious contact with God. So the answer to getting thrown, thank you. So the answer to every problem is to get closer to God. We can talk about rah, 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 but eventually we go there. And when do we go there? As a last resort. After we try every other thing. Well, I talked to a therapist. Well, I did this. And now I'm running. And now I'm running. Oh, God, none of that stuff works. I'm going to go to God. So, just like acceptance, just like forgiveness that I talked about at the beginning of the meeting, go to God first. Leave all the rest of it out. Leave it all out. Just go there first. Just bring whatever it is. God, now I need your help with this. And just stay with him and thank him for being there. Tell him you'd rather be with him than anywhere else. And your whole life will be transformed. And I love you all. Thank you very much.
In 2007, Sandy did a 12-week series in his hometown of Tampa, Florida, on the history and steps of AA. Each week he would tell a little story about AA history and then tell some stories about our steps. This is an excerpt from CD number 4, where Sandy tells a wonderful story about early AA in Akron, Ohio.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. AA doesn't promote itself and hire an advertising agency. And Liberty Magazine, where there was a story, AA and God, or Alcoholics and God. And it was kind of a religious thing, but it did get a few inquiries, but not as many as the other one. And the other one was concerned a baseball player for the Cleveland Indians named Raleigh Helmsley. Now, Raleigh Helmsley was an all-star catcher in the 30s and 40s for the Cleveland Indians and caught Bob Feller, who, when I was growing up, you said Bob Feller and you went, that's the fastest pitch there is.
and he was a pretty famous pitcher. Well, Helmsley's performance as a baseball player began to drop off significantly as his alcoholism progressed. He was able to keep it under control for a while, but as time took its toll, his performance slacked and his batting average dropped, and the manager of the Cleveland Indians became concerned. And he, through a friend or some little story, heard about the Oxford group. And there was a group in Cleveland, because AA hadn't been started. So he went to the Oxford group and he said, "How much to get Helmsley sober?" Because he's a very valuable player to us, and we'll pay good dollars to get him. Of course, the Oxford group is going, "No, there's no money involved." But he has to join an Oxford group, and we are getting some alcoholics sober in these groups. As a matter of fact, we have a hospital in Akron, which is where he has to start out. And, of course, that was Dr. Bob down in St. Thomas Hospital in Akron. And the manager said, "Well, he won't go to a hospital. There's no way. I've tried to talk to him about it. He doesn't like how he's not going to go to a hospital." And the Oxford group says, "Well, unless he goes there, there's nothing that can be done." So they finagled with an opposing pitcher to deliberately hit him. And then the trainer ran out, and it was a very minor injury, but he declared that he had to go to the hospital. The injury was so bad, and so off they shipped him down to Akron, and he had no idea what was coming, but he was on his way to getting sober, which he did. And as he developed 1 and 2 years sobriety moving into 1941, his performance on the field skyrocketed. His batting average goes up, and he's not making any errors, and he's throwing people out at second, and it was, wow. So the reporters are coming around, and they're going, "To what do you owe this? How come you're suddenly doing so well?" He said, "Oh, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything is turning out wonderful." And they said, "Oh, really? Well, tell us all about it." "Well, in this little organization, I go down, and they work on me. It's just amazing what they're doing." Well, that story went in all kinds of major newspapers in the sports sections, and sporting enthusiast alcoholics read it. And some of them said, "Well, if it's good enough for Raleigh Helmsley, it's good enough for me." So we see an early example of anonymity breaks doing some good. And Bill was, they didn't really capture the anonymity till a little bit later. And there were, people were getting their picture taken. And when they did the Jack Alexander article, there was a picture taken of AA members. Now, the other character that was played a predominant role at this time was a very famous AA who got sober in 1938, probably AA number 10 or 11, and his name was Clarence Snyder. Now, Clarence's story is absolutely amazing. I think he was born in 1902 in Cleveland, was a super everything. Super salesman, super anything, that athlete, dancer, you just name it, until drinking came along, and he was one of those alcoholics that, wham, when it hit like a ton of bricks. So he had gotten married, and his wife, who also joined AA later on, became very concerned with his drinking because he's being fired from everything, and she's trying to get him to go to a hospital, and he's now just drinking around the clock like a crazy man and totally unpredictable, and she was thinking of having him locked up, reaching her last straw with him. And her brother was a truck driver. So she said to her brother, "What if you have Clarence stay with you in the truck. And if you keep him up in that compartment on the top of the truck while you drive all over the country, there's no way that he can get drunk. Which is true. And so they started off on this trucker's, Daniel, you'll appreciate this, on this trucking route with Clarence up in the thing there. Well, of course, there's a few days without a drink. He's going nuts in there, and he's trying to dream up things to tell his brother. And his brother was tired and everything, and Clarence said, look, why don't you go get a meal, freshen up, and I'll guard the truck while you're gone. And, of course, guarding the truck included going down to some gin mill and getting some cheap whiskey and coming back, and his brother finds him drunk guarding his truck. And that ended the relationship, and he said they were on their way to New York City, and he just dumped him. He just dumped him on the streets in New York City. And Clarence is trying to survive there, and he had a sister-in-law that lived there that he had befriended earlier and really did a lot of things. So, I mean, really saved her house and did some tremendous things. And he figured, she really owed me a favor. So he calls her and says, you remember all the things I did? Well, maybe I could come by. Oh, yeah, sure, Clarence. And she wasn't aware of the exact condition that he was in. And when he came over, she just slammed the door on him. And just said, I'm sorry, but I'm not helping you. You just stay out there. And somehow he worked his way back to Ohio and decided to return to his wife. And he came home, and she looked at him through the door and knew better than to open it. And just started telling him, no, you're not coming in. I know it sounds hard, but you're not getting in. And he said, well, I'm going to die, and it's hopeless, it's hopeless. And the funny thing is that her sister had called her, telling her that Clarence had been there, and also that her sister had heard from a doctor in New York that there was a doctor in Akron that could help Clarence. And the doctor in New York was Bill's brother-in-law, Leonard Strong, who was a big player in getting Bill to see Rockefeller. He paid for Bill to go to Towns Hospital. His name is pretty well known in AA history. And that's where Clarence found out about Dr. Bob, was through Bill's brother-in-law. Anyway, he hemmed and hawed about going down there, trying to get his wife to give him the travel money to go to Akron on the bus. And she knew if he gave him the travel money to go to Akron, he would drink the travel money and he would still be there outside her door in Cleveland. So she went down to the bus company with him, bought the ticket, and made him get on while she was watching, so they stamped the ticket and he couldn't get a refund out of it. And then she followed the bus for the first for the two other stops in Akron until it hit the main road for Cleveland. I mean, the other way around, until it hit the main road for Akron, and off he went and was dumped out there, and finally made his way to see Dr. Bob. And they check him in the hospital. And this is how the Oxford group worked back then. They checked him in the hospital, and he recovered physically for 3 or 4 days. Then Dr. Bob came by. He's a big man. And he said, all right, son, you're ready. And he said, ready for what? He said, ready for God. Son, I want to know something. I want to know it right now. Do you believe in God? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. No, you can't be not sure. You either believe or you don't. Now, what's your decision? Well, maybe, I guess. So. No, you don't get so. Yes or no. That's a lot of pressure. When you're sitting in a little short nightie on a bed with 4 days of sobriety. He said, okay, I do. Okay, get on your knees. Why? Because we're going to pray. In this little short 90? Yeah, get down on the... So he got down there, and this is what Clarence said Dr. Bob told to him. They got down on the knees, and Dr. Bob looked up and said, Jesus, this is Clarence Snyder. He's a drunk. Clarence, this is Jesus. You ask him to help you stop drinking and to manage your life. Okay. Jesus, could you please manage my life and help me keep sober? And then he stood him up and he said, good man, you're on your way. Now go back to Cleveland, and start sobering up drunks. He's only got a week's sobriety. Go back to Cleveland, start sobering up drunks. Because you weren't an official member until you brought back somebody, and then they got sober, and then you were in. You are now a full-fledged member. Now, Clarence is a good salesman, and he's back there talking to people right and left because he wants to hurry up and get somebody to go down to Akron with him. And he was going to weekly meetings in the Williams home, which is where the AAs in Akron were meeting with the Oxford people. Wonderful couple. When you go out to Akron, that's on the tours to go by the Williams home. Anyway, he's not getting anybody. The drunks are just listening, but he's not closing any deals with these guys. And he runs across a guy with alcoholic paralysis. This is one of my favorite AA stories of all times. Alcohol paralysis is where you're lying on the ground and you can't move, but you're conscious. So you can talk and people can talk to you, but you can't get away. So Clarence can work on closing the deal as long as he wants. The guy can't get away. So he's kneeling down by his side. And son, you want to get sober? I'm going to take you down to Akron. They got a hot. I don't want to do any of that. And he just keeps pressuring. And finally he says, okay. And he says, well, have you got $50? It costs $50 to go through Dr. Bob's hospital. That ain't bad for 5 days in a hospital. And he said, no, I haven't got any money. I mean, who had money lying in Skid Row? He said, but my mother, if she knew that I was willing to go to the hospital to recover from being a drunk, she would advance the $50 just like that. And Clarence said, where does she live? Now, this is Clarence. He's not going to wait for him to get sober and go out there. Where does your mother live? All right. And it was way out of town in the country. And he went and borrowed a car. He got somebody to loan him a car. He went right out there, you know, that same day and drove out. And pretty soon the regular road ended. He's on a dirt road. And pretty soon that ended. And it's kind of a trail. And the hunting season was going on. People are shooting. And he's walking through the woods to some address out there. And finally he sees it. It's a small farmhouse. He goes up to the door, knocks on the door, and this elderly woman comes. And he says, are you Mrs. Ryan or whatever the man? And she shakes her head, Ryan, the name. And he says, well, I'm here because your son is lying on that. And she's going, you know. She was Polish and didn't speak English. And so he's talking to his mother, but he cannot communicate. She recognizes his son's name and something like that. And there was a young 8-year-old girl who was attending school and had learned English and became the translator between the two and communicated the message so that the mother gave him $50. He went back and got this man down, and he got sober. And so Clarence was AA's top 12-stepper. That's without a doubt. I mean, Dr. Bob had them all coming in the hospital, but we're talking about going out and getting people and bringing them down. And he got into the automobile business. He was such a top salesman, they gave him two demonstrators. Now, not many car dealers where the salesman gets one of each type model to take home, but he did. And he used the two cars to ferry down the Cleveland contingent to the Akron meetings. That's how many people he was getting sober, and he's bringing them down to the Williams house. Anyway, this is going on for a year or so, and he noticed that almost everybody in the car was Roman Catholic. I don't know why he had so many Roman Catholics up there in Cleveland, but his carload was almost all Roman Catholics. And something happened when the Roman Catholic guys got sober. Their churches noticed the difference. And they would go up and go, "Pat, you look wonderful. What's going on?" "Oh, Father, God is saving me. I found the Oxford group down in Akron, a Protestant organization." Definitely not approved by the Pope. And they go, "Oh, Pat, you really shouldn't be going there." "But Father, it's saving my life." And then pretty soon there's two other guys and then three, and the church feels like it's got a rebellion on its hands. And they actually were calling them in, saying if they keep going to the Oxford Protestant organization, there's a chance they'll be excommunicated. Now, that creates a heck of a dilemma because, you know, both of them are terrible choices. And so Clarence is thinking as he's driving down there that what we need is a group outside of Oxford where we do the same thing. You follow what I'm saying? We'll just meet over here. We'll call it something else. And that way these guys can keep getting sober. So he advanced the idea to Dr. Bob. And he said, somebody that he brought down named Abby, driving his wife back home, he was talking about he wished he had a place where they could meet in Cleveland. She said, "Oh, you can use our house. It would be perfect. It's a great big house. Our children are all gone. And besides, if you're meeting there, when my husband gets out, he'll have no choice but to go." And so Clarence tucked that away in the back of his head, and he went down there and he talked to Dr. Baum, and he said, "You know, I got these Catholics, and they're liable to get excommunicated if they keep coming down here. So I'm thinking of starting a separate meeting up in Cleveland." And Dr. Bob just went berserk because he did not want to upset the Williams and all the hospitality that they had. So he was caught in a tough place. And he said, no, don't do that. Well, Clarence went home and thought about it, and he came back the next week and he said, "I know I'm not supposed to go against my sponsor, but I'm starting that thing. And it's going to be Thursday night at this address." And lo and behold, he did. He went up there, and the Akron contingent came up and tried to stop the meeting. But they weren't successful. And here's the quirk in history that Clarence parlayed into a lot of controversy. The Big Book had come out, and the name Alcoholics Anonymous was now being used for the alcoholic squads that met separately, like Bill Wilson would go to the Oxford group in New York, and then he'd have the drunks come over his house for a separate little meeting. And that was starting to irritate the Oxford groupers in New York, but Akron, they were more cool with that idea. And Dr. Bob just didn't want to upset them. Anyway, the book came out, and so Clarence decided that what I'm going to call this group is Alcoholics Anonymous, after the Big Book. Well, technically, that was the first group to call itself Alcoholics Anonymous. Which, if you want to use your ego and really stretch a point, you could later claim to be the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, which Clarence did boldly in the newspapers with no anonymity, go on radio shows. Tonight we are interviewing the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Clarence Snyder. And this was not going over well in New York. But he was amazing. He wrote sponsorship pamphlets. He wrote the first intergroup in Cleveland. He had institution things, how to go to a jail, all kinds of stuff. And his vision for the future of AA was that the major centers around the country would do their own thing. In other words, Cleveland would put together all their pamphlets and all this and the telephone numbers, and they would get the word out, and they would do all that, and Dallas could do that, and Los Angeles could do that. And the last thing we need is some central office telling all of us what to do. So you can see there is some tension building. And the second level of tension was New York. Even when I got sober in D.C., you would find the old-timers, they would say, let me tell you the whole program. I can condense it down to two simple things. Don't drink and go to meetings. That was the whole program. Don't drink and go to meetings. Whereas Clarence and out in Akron, it was serve God, pray, help others. You follow what I'm saying? It was totally spiritual. And New York was, just don't drink. What's the problem? If you don't drink, you can't get drunk. What's the problem? And that tension exists today. I mean, you hear, you know, New York, we'd like to make it more psychological. The last thing I heard was that there's no groups left in New York that say the Lord's Prayer. I don't want to do that. That reminds me too much of religion. We're going to get rid of that. And I think they say the Serenity Prayer. And then out in Akron, we got to go back to basics. We got to go back, and you hear, we got to go back to basics. We got to get... And between those two tensions, we got the wonderful middle ground known as our 12-step program, and God as we understand Him. And it's a real blessing. It's nice to have that kind of tension because it will allow you to think about things from different perspectives. And it's still going on. And it's still going on. Somebody went to Founders Day and they brought me back a pamphlet from the Cleveland Intergroup, The Four Absolutes, which were part of the thing. And it was just you read that and you realize there's no way to stay sober without them. You see what I'm saying? And that's fundamentalism. And then over here we go, what are they? Could you please go through them? So people seem to be staying sober and happy without them, but they shouldn't be able to. So I'm not taking sides. I love both of it. I think that's so healthy, and I really enjoy it.